Hello, everybody, and welcome to our extended free preview of our What a Cartoon Movie episode all about The Hunchback of Notre Dame. I am one of your hosts, the earner of calumny and consternation, Bob Mackey, and who is here with me today?
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, and this podcast is turning me to sin.
Oh, no. And of course, this is our monthly What a Cartoon Movie podcast. And if you're on the $5 Patreon level or on the free feed, you get to hear a little snippet of that, in this case, like a 45-minute to an hour snippet of what is going to be a five-hour podcast. And for the 25th anniversary, of course, we covered The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Disney's dark movie of their 90s renaissance.
The darkest of dark, and while still rated G, it might be one of the darkest G-rated movies ever that only Disney at the height of their powers could get away with.
That is true. And yes, this is a massive podcast about a classic movie that's often overlooked. And because you're on the free feed or the $5 level, you'll hear a little preview of our history of Hunchback, which could be, I think, our longest history of a history section to date. If not, it's up there.
It's up there. I think it could be. And yeah, Bob brought so much passion to it. He is the Hunchback fan number one. Mm-hmm. And he's I have a hunch you'll enjoy it.
I was waiting for you to say that. But yes, if you like this free preview, you want to hear the whole thing, head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Sign up for the $10 level and you'll get to hear the rest of the podcast, the remaining 4 hours, and also nearly three entire years worth of What a Cartoon Movie episodes. We have done so much since November of 2018. We've been doing these monthly episodes. Each one is between 3 to 5 hours long, and they follow the same format as What a Cartoon and Talking Simpsons. We have a history segment, and then we go bit by bit through the movie with clips, and it's a very, very long discussion. These are always our longest podcasts we put out, and we're always saying, will this one be the longest?
Yes.
editing is not done as of this recording, but this one could be the longest.
It might beat End of Evangelion for 5 hours long. And yeah, I think, you know, we've covered so many, to list them all would take too long, but I definitely think if you have been enjoying our Disney Renaissance summer, we did Hercules before this. Next month, we're doing The Lion King. I think you'd really enjoy all the previous Disney ones we did, like A Goofy Movie, Aladdin, The Great Mouse Detective, and many, many more. Plus, this is part of the Katzenberg saga, so you probably also really enjoy the one we did about Shrek this year as well, and so many others. On top of all the $5 things you get with the $10 thing, I'd say just from What a Cartoon Movie, by my calculations, you'd get over 150 hours of exclusive, super premium, awesome podcasts me and Bob put a ton of work into, and I think you'll really enjoy them.
So again, that is patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Thanks so much for listening to this little spiel at the front. We'll let you get to our little preview of our entire podcast, all about The Hunchback of Notre Dame. So hold on to your seats, because it is not just a movie. It's also a very famous book by a very famous author based on a very famous building. So there are multiple histories going on here, and our history goes all the way back to the early 19th century, specifically 1802, with the birth of Victor Hugo, possibly the most well-known French novelist. Personally, I love Alexandre Dumas more. Mm. That's just my own thing, because I love The Count of Monte Cristo. It's my favorite book.
Good old Yeah, you love that Count of Monte Cristo. I'll say I've never read an actual book of either of them. I know all their adaptations.
This is my time to brag. Yes. I read The Hunchback of Notre Dame. It is 900 and some pages. The Count of Monte Cristo is like 1,300 pages, and I read it one summer, and it was worth it.
Wow.
Read the 2003 translation, please. It's really, really good.
You know, the closest I got was in my biggest phase of loving Les Miserables, the musical. I was like, you know what? I should really read Victor Hugo's original of Les Mis. He wrote Les Mis as well, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so I gave it two chapters and I just bounced off. I was like, to just feel so many pages in front of you when you're moving a book, it can feel daunting.
The mystery of the Kindle book might help you because you don't know, like, you're not holding a giant tome.
Yeah, that's true. You can look at the bottom to see the percentage thing, but
you can turn that off.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So I have a master's in literature. I don't want to turn this into a class on Victor Hugo. Yes, I'm bragging about my degrees, but I'm still paying for it. So going over the broad strokes of his life. So he was part of the Romantic movement with a capital R, and that rejected modernity and rationalism as the Industrial Revolution was beginning to, you know, get into motion, because it turned every city into a disgusting hell pit full of, like, black skies and disfigured children and just sewage running through the streets. It was a bad time. So they're like, this modernism sucks. The Gothic lifestyle is where we want to be. We want to be in the pastoral world and think about individualism and emotions and not the cold calculating, you know, Industrial Revolution world that we are living around.
And back then, writers didn't have, you know, social media to shout at each other about this. So you got to write a whole book to explain how you feel these things.
Oh, Victor Hugo was a poster. There are posters throughout all of time. He wrote pamphlets. It's a political pamphlet. So he was on their version of Twitter.
I was thinking of these contemporaries of his, of like, you know, like, say, Karl Marx or Oscar Wilde. Like, they were posters as well of like, oh, well, this guy sucks. And here's the whole, I wrote a whole essay about
Martin Luther was the first poster. He posted on the doors of that church.
That's true. Yeah,
his theses. Yes, Hugo, he led a long and rich life, was super political. He was an artist. He did all of these things. He was a public intellectual and a novelist, and also a fierce opponent of the Catholic Church, slavery, the death penalty, and Napoleon III, to the point where he was exiled from France because he opposed that leader.
Wow.
And I don't want to go into French history because I know very little about it, but he was super into social justice, and you can see this in all of his works.
No, that's, I mean, you can absolutely feel it in both this and Les Mis. Like, Les Mis is, it is about, you know, the main character in Les Miserables is, you know, a thief. Like, he's a thief who proved that he could change, even though society through Javert, the, you know, the police officer who tells him you can't change, you're always a thief. He's proven wrong. Like, it's about how the lower class is viewed wrongly by the those in charge.
He truly was a leftist of his time. So prolific writer and artist. The original book is called Notre Dame de Paris, which is just Our Lady of Notre Dame, which is the name of the church. So the original name of the book is just the name of the building.
Man, you know, you're hiding the biggest asset of this, the hunchback.
Well,
also feels insensitive to use the term hunchback.
We're going
to
get into it, but he's a minor character at best in the book.
Okay.
Notre Dame de Paris is one of his best known works. Possibly second to Les Miserables, also a musical of a similar tone. I think at this point, probably Les Miserables is the bigger name, but I'm not really sure.
You know, it's close. I'd currently say Les Mis just because there was the film adaptation of the musical.
I heard that sucked.
It's not very good. It mostly sucks. Russell Crowe can't sing. But you know, all we need is just one new Hunchback adaptation to get it back in front of people.
And it's not Hunchback 2, which is also on Disney Plus. I will watch it someday because it is anime.
Yes,
let's not forget that. So this novel came out in 1831 when he was 28 years old. You know what I was doing when I was 28? When I was 28, I was like, you know what, I think I'll watch all of Seinfeld again. And I did. But he wrote a 900-page book about Notre Dame.
That brings me, man, 28.
Yes.
Geez. I mean, you know, for him, though, back then, 28 was like, you're lucky if you're middle-aged at 28.
The clock is ticking on me right here. So let's rewind to the year 1260, when the Catholic Cathedral Notre Dame had finished construction. It's kind of always under construction, but when Hugo's book released, this very famous building was nearly 600 years old. This was not a new building.
Okay.
And Romanticism was very much about the appreciation of medieval culture, in this case, medieval architecture. And Victor Hugo was very upset with how much Notre Dame was falling into disrepair and how much of it was being renovated to fit a more modern style. Like, one instance given historically is that the beautiful stained glass windows, they were being replaced by just white glass because people were like, well, that lets and more lights. They're being practical instead of romantic,
right,
with a big R.
Right. Man, wow, that's sad to see it. That's what drove him to this.
So Hugo loved Gothic architecture, and he set out to write a novel with Notre Dame as his backdrop in a way to call attention to this cathedral to prevent it from being destroyed or ruined. So So this is all just PR for a cathedral. And he's not even that religious anymore. Like, he grew up Catholic, but then he's like, you know what? The Catholic Church sucks, but this building was just a monument to beautiful architecture that was falling out of fashion.
It's still insane to me people are still Catholics. I
don't. Yeah, I don't. They should just melt down the Vatican and sell all the money to charity.
Yeah, it seems. It seems insane to me. But yes. Oh well.
A lot of this book and the book is. I thought the book was good, but a lot of the book that I didn't like was, I'm just going to describe this building for 40 pages, and you're going to read it.
There's, you know, a very similar thing to me is in a lot of Alan Moore's works, he really gets into describing something for a long time. The big one is in his comic From Hell. There is one, if you get to the third chapter, I believe, they just spend the entire time talking about the landscape layout of London. And just like, and this street goes to this street, and it was designed to this and this. And that is his attempt, I think, to shove you out of the book. He's like, if you can't stick with this and you skip this, you suck. You're not good enough for my book.
The section of the novel, which is like two chapters where he describes the cathedral and the landscape around it, it is right in the middle of the book. And I feel like it was made for people in Paris at the time, because he's like, oh, well, of course, this river is here and this area, this town is over here, and you can see the sunset over here. It's like, I'll take your word for it, buddy. This could all be made up. I have no idea.
This magical land of Paris. Who'd ever think it could exist?
So the book released to great acclaim in 1831. Again, Hugo was only 28. And only 2 years later, it received its first English translation in 1833 as The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which is now the most popular title of the book. So whoever localized it said, this hunchback guy, he's going to sell books.
Yeah. I would assume it was a British localization then, not an American English localization.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, it's right across the channel. So yeah. I figure they'd be like, oh, that's selling pretty good in France. Let's, I can change these. Get that hunchback on the cover, mate.
But again, a minor character in the book, and we'll talk about why later. But I couldn't find a reason. I'm guessing the publisher thought it was a more compelling title. Also, the book was written to call attention to the cathedral, so maybe it was not that well known at the time. It was like, it was written for people in France, that book. Mm-hmm. So if you just name a book after a building and then sell it in England or America, people are going to be like, what is this?
Yes.
What is Our Lady of Notre Dame? What is Our Lady of Paris, rather?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you just would say, you'd be like, is this a tourist book? Like, I mean, I guess back then the novel was a, you know, new idea, I suppose, too. Like, that's, I would guess that book isn't written like some of the earliest, like, you know, Sherlock Holmes books or the Moby Dick that are, you know, like a letter home or whatever, right?
That's an epistolary book, Henry.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And that was about a century earlier.
Oh, sorry.
But I know what you mean. No, these are not a series of letters like Dracula.
Okay.
A lot of the early women writers would write books like that because otherwise the church would be like, that book is full of lies.
I see.
None of that happened. Okay. This book is a period piece. It takes place in 1482, 349 years before the publication. So it's looking back at the medieval era, which all of these romantics loved, even though it also kind of sucked for different reasons.
Yeah, I mean, the world it paints, or the adaptations that it paints of, like, it seems to accept, oh yeah, there was so much inequality and awfulness back then in France.
Plagues, all kinds of fun diseases, and
30 years war, that'll then lead to 100 years war.
We hear about this war that Phoebus came from, and it's not clear what war it was he was fighting at this time. So yes, so more about the book. It's incredibly dark and depressing, which is probably why I liked it as a brooding 14-year-old. Disney did not have the first adaptation to change things up a lot. Many people did, because the book is unpalatable to a mass market audience who wants to see a movie. So I can tell you what the original story is and how it ends. No spoilers here, because you might not want to read it after this. So in the end of the story, Esmeralda is hanged and she dies. When Frollo laughs at this, Quasimodo shoves him out of the tower and Frollo dies. And in the final pages, in the epilogue, they talk about this mass grave that all the beggars and, you know, Romani are thrown into after being executed. Just a big open grave full of skeletons and corpses. And they find Quasimodo's skeleton embracing Esmeralda's skeleton, and it crumbles to dust. So after Esmeralda died and was thrown in a pit of corpses, Quasimodo went to the pit of corpses, held her body until he wasted away and then also died. And the end of the book ends with the titular character's skeleton crumbling after people find it in the future. That is the end of this book.
Wow. Man, that...
Good night, everybody.
That is so heavy and dark, but I guess, you know... back then he didn't have an editor telling him like, hey, they should have give people something.
Yeah.
Don't leave people with just complete sadness.
It's it was written to make you feel.
I mean,
it certainly did.
I guess it could have been worse if Frollo like lived, like at least he gets killed in that. But
and like Phoebus is cursed to an unhappy marriage with some other character who's not in this movie. So the Phoebus has a dark fate, but it's just like I'm stuck with this woman I hate.
I mean, too, the Quasimodo, like he's not from reading bullet pointed lists of like what he was like in the original book, he's not I mean he's deaf, sounds like he can't even speak, like he's not much of a full he's half formed perhaps. Mm-hmm. as the word means.
Yeah, Quasimodo, he's deaf and sort of simple in quotes and has one working eye, so Disney does a lot to clean him up and make him more presentable. And what surprised me is that in Hugo's book there are still a few very Disney things that Disney does in a lot of their movies. So in Hugo's book, Frollo falls to his death, which is the death of every Disney villain.
Yes. Yeah.
Also, when I saw this movie, I was like, oh, Jolly the Goat, that's a Disney invention. They just needed a wacky sidekick. No, the Jolly the Goat is in the book.
I can't believe that. That's crazy. Jolly the Goat, I was sure of, like, every princess is given an animal friend. It is merchandising 101. I just imagine, like, the producers of this movie, when they approach the book, like, holy crap, we don't even have to make up a goat for her. She's got herself a little goat.
Thank you, Victor. And I think that it was they didn't make any more sidekicks because Pocahontas had like three. There was the hummingbird and the raccoon for Pocahontas, and then the villain had his own cute animal sidekick. So they were into overdrive on that movie.
That was overload of it, to be sure. Yeah, and then like Hercules, I guess really Hercules has like two sidekicks in Phil and the Pegasus, and then on top of that, the villain's got Pain and Panic, and kind of sort of Meg is his sidekick in some scenes too. It's this feels low. Everybody makes fun of the gargoyles, but this feels low on sidekicks by comparison.
And Jolly doesn't get a lot of screen time, and I guess a few burp jokes, and that's basically it. So you may be saying, oh, they Disney-fied this book. They ruined it. Well, guess what? Hugo ruined his own work, in quotes, ruined, because after he wrote this book, he's like, oh, I want to make this book into an opera. And the opera version of this book called La Esmeralda has a much happier ending in that only Phoebus is the one who dies.
Wow.
So even Hugo was like, this book's a downer. If I want an audience to see a production of it, they're going to be upset if everyone dies and the main guy's skeleton crumbles.
That's so fun to think. Yeah, if somebody reads it in a book alone, that's one thing. But if you're in an audience full of people and you're just left with like, well, this person you just watched a whole thing about, both of them are just a skeleton and then they crumble like that. That is a bring down. How do you go home and have a date night with your honey, with your French honey?
Date night in the 1830s.
Yeah, it's like, hey, we're going to see this. We're going to go on the Parisian bistro after this. And, you know, we're just going to be thinking about how Quasimodo died.
But yeah, he Disney-fied his own work.
That's
so
nice.
I mean, there's a time and place for everything. And the time for this much of a downer is a book.
Yes. Yeah.
Before this movie, the most notable pop culture adaptation was definitely the 1939 Charles Laughton movie, where he played Quasimodo. And his portrayal defined the character from that point onward. When there was like an Igor or Hunchback style character, they were doing, and probably still are doing, the Charles Laughton voice for the character, which I'll play a clip of later, but it's way, way different than Tom Hulse's version of Quasimodo.
When you hear the word sanctuary in this film, like I think of, I'm not going to imitate it. It feels wrong to do it, but the way you did that, I just watched a Muppet show that had, I forget what song they're doing, but it was a Quasimodo and gargoyles singing a song, and he's doing the Charles Laughton simple voice, and that was one of the ones that had the warning at the start of has portrayals that are not good. Now I was like, oh, it's about Quasimodo, I'm sure.
And of course Lon Chaney played him in the silent version, but yes, Charles Laughton, I will say it's a great performance. It's a transformative performance, and not something that would probably be done today though,
and it turned him into one of the universal monsters, which is not, you know, fair to him. He's not not. He's a guy with a punched back.
He's a tortured man who's like locked away.
Yeah, he's not. He didn't turn into a werewolf. He's not Dracula. But
a bell fell on him and it transformed him.
I was just watching our friend Matt McMuscles did a thing on the Dark Universe and the end of the Dark Universe and how they've had plans for a Quasimodo of the Dark Universe as well.
Oh.
He was part of he's in the Universal Monster family because of that film. Wow. Yeah.
God, that sucks. Anyways, moving on, let's talk about real life Notre Dame. Yes, I want to put this here. So there was a fire,
yes.
A devastating fire in April of 2019. It took 500 firefighters to put out this blaze. And to make a long story short, because the building is owned by the country of France, it has been since the early 20th century, they're hoping to have renovations completed before the 2024 Paris Summer Olympics start. So it was a very devastating fire, and it makes me wish, God, I wish I could have went there before this happened.
Yeah.
Because seeing this movie, I was like, I have to go here. I have to see this.
Yeah, I mean, especially now I've always wanted to go to, I've never been to Europe. I say this every time when I'm like, well, I think about spending money on a trip. I just want to go back to Tokyo because I love Tokyo so much, but I really should expand my mind and travel Europe to some. I believe your wife speaks French too. So
I think so.
you wouldn't be as lost as I might be.
You just reminded me of that. Yes. We're going, the Simpsons are going to Notre Dame. Again, up front, that is the history of the book, the author, and the building as briefly as I could do it.
Yeah, I should have looked into that more too, but I think there was that thing of like when it was on fire, a lot of the Western civilization lovers out there were like, oh, it burns, and I bet it probably was a Muslim that did it. It's like,
Antifa. Antifa did it.
Yeah, all that dumb shit. And then I believe it was that rich people said they'd pay to fix it, and not one rich person actually gave any money to France to do it.
I think the fire was caused by they were renovating it, and some of the renovation work caused the fire.
Yeah, it was a fucking accident. It's like, but I mean, we all jump to our boogeymen in these times and moments. They can't blame, you know, the Romani people like they did back then. So I guess it must have been Antifa or a Muslim terrorist. Yes.
So now we can move on to the more exciting part of this. The movie history of The Hunchback of Notre Dame. So I have lots of sources outside of this, but thankfully Slash Film had a recent oral history on this movie for its 25th anniversary. It's very long.
Oh, badass.
Yes, lots of new information. I read the entire thing. I recommend you do as well, because a lot of what I'll be saying is in that, but I did read like every interview I could find, and thankfully like articles from 1996 are still internet archived.
Oh, that's
so
good.
You can read like news of the time of Disney like releasing this movie, what critics thought, what like audiences thought, and things like that.
Yeah, that was helpful with Hercules as well. Just of the archive stuff was very well saved, but unfortunately back in the mid 90s it was seen as mainstream enough that like the LA Times or the New York Times would actually write about it, as opposed to in the 80s it feels like animated films were less covered in the old gray lady or major publications.
Nobody
like
wanted to hear about the Great Mouse Detective.
No way. Yeah, that's for babies. Like, I mean, if it was to write about that and Care Bears the movie, I can see why an entertainment writer's like, I don't think so.
I'd have to watch both of these.
Yeah.
So yes, our story begins with, I think, two guys who are not given enough acclaim, and that's Gary Trousdale and Kirk Wise, who are not spoken of as often as Musker and Clements.
Yeah,
the great Musker and Clements, who I like a lot.
Oh, Musker and Clements are great, yeah. but they do take all the credit, especially when it's like, these two guys directed my favorite Renaissance film, which and your favorite one too, but we never talk of them. Like, I don't say Trousdale and Wise like I say Musker and Clements, you know. It's just shorthand, like, well, everybody knows Musker and Clements. Yeah
And these guys were hot at Disney because, yes, as you said, Henry, as you implied, Henry, they directed the Oscar nominated Beauty and the Beast, a big thing for Disney to get nominated for Best Picture 10 years before there was a Best Animated Feature category. Of course, it lost to Silence of the Lambs, but still, that was an important moment in animation where it's like it was being recognized as on the same level as all of those films.
I mean it was also like a reward for how well Little Mermaid had done, that the Oscars could then look at the next film from Disney as that same level of prestige and worthy of it. And also, like, it was Beauty and the Beast had just such amazing songs that it was, that were also animated perfectly. Like, the songs are great on their own, but Be Our Guest and Beauty and the Beast, like, some of the most, like, gorgeous animation Disney ever did.
Definitely. Yeah. They're a great talent. So more on them. So again, when you're at Disney, you direct a movie like every 5 years because they take so long to, you know, pre-produce, produce, and then post-produce. So they directed Beauty and the Beast, and then they directed Hunchback Notre Dame, and then they directed Atlantis, The Lost Empire, mega failure for Disney when they kept trying to make movies for young boys until they just shrugged and said, let's just buy Star Wars and Marvel.
I'm going to give that one another shot. The listeners have said we've been too harsh to it or treat it, but box office wise, it was a failure and did change Disney for the worse.
I got to see it. The Mike Mignola designs, Michael J. Fox is the main character. I think at the time I was like a huge insufferable anime nerd. I was like, they ripped off Nadia.
Not knowing that we knew now, like, well, Nadia ripped off a lot of other stuff. And also I recall when that first came out, future friend of mine, Jeremy Parrish, and your co-host on Retronauts, he was like, oh, I'm the star of this movie. Like, that's me.
I'm sure he hates it. So please tweet that at him. So yes, I don't like where their careers went. I feel like, boy, they directed this movie and then this happened to them. So let's talk about their careers. So Trailsdale went to DreamWorks after Atlantis. He's directed a lot of Shrek, Madagascar, and Kung Fu Panda specials.
Specials?
Yes. Like Shrek the Halls and Shrek's Giving or whatever. A very Shrek Flag Day. I don't know.
That's terrible. He should have been handed a theatrical unit at DreamWorks. That's insane that he...
I assume he got paid a lot of money, but... The sheer quality of this movie, and then to see him go work at DreamWorks on these lesser things. So
I hope Katzenberg at least handed him a big old check for that.
He definitely was probably recruited right after. And the last DreamWorks thing he did was when that Mr. Peabody and Sherman movie came out, on the Blu-ray, there is a Bullwinkle CGI short. He directed that in 2014. That's the last thing he directed. And they were fairly young in making Hunchback, so he's maybe like not even 60 yet. So I'm not sure if he's retired yet.
Man, I should have. I didn't watch that Bullwinkle short, even though we did that whole Bullwinkle episode. I give that a watch.
It's buried on a movie on a Blu-ray that nobody wants. Nobody asked for a Mr. Sherman. Sorry. Peabody and Mr. Sherman. Is that it?
No, Mr. Peabody and Sherman.
Okay.
Yeah.
I always mess up. Okay. So yes, that's what happened to Trailsdale. And then Wise, I feel like this guy's a real mystery because it feels like he retired or semi-retired in his late 30s based on his IMDb, or maybe he's just teaching. But seemingly he came out of the shadows to direct, please watch this trailer, 2020's Bobbleheads the Movie, which looks awful.
What?
Yes.
What?
Yes.
That does sound crazy. I'm going to look this up after the podcast.
Yeah. When you see this, you're like, I would rather watch The Emoji Movie. This is like the version of Toy Story you see in the checkout lane of the dollar store and be like, my kid will watch this crap.
I was exploring Tubi recently, and in their kids section is like, there's five things I've heard of. And then it's like, the ripoff of a ripoff of a ripoff of something. I'm like, I've never heard of this. This can't have had any budget behind it. Oh my God.
And it made me want to look into the history of the Bobbleheads movie, and which we're not going to cover that on this, but I was like, the last time Bobbleheads were huge was when I was working in retail in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And that went away by like 2006. So this movie must have been passed around for maybe 17 years before someone finally made it in 2020. Some rights were about to expire.
It's got to be that. I feel like if you're the Bobblehead people in those meetings, you're like, look, we know you can't afford the Funko Pop license, so can get bobbleheads from us. You got that.
It does feel like Coupon the Movie. You know, exactly. It's like people like the bobbleheads. They're going to like the movie.
They'll see the movie. To see those bobbleheads walking. Who hasn't held a bobblehead in their hand and thought, what if these guys could talk?
You know what? Not to go on too long about this, but the only joke about them is that their heads bobble. And every joke in the trailer is that.
So I was like,
you could maybe get two good jokes out of a bobbling head on a character, but that's what the entire movie is.
Oh, man, that's you're not going to like our NYPD shoe sketch.
Exactly. It is really mad about shoe. All right, so how'd this movie get made? So Wise and Trailsdale taking some time off after Beauty and the Beast, but then they're told, hey, guys, you got to actually work at Disney. You can't just sit around doing nothing, so start on a new project. So their next project was something called Song of the Sea, a retelling of the Orpheus myth starring humpback whales. And yeah, they didn't make this, but this idea was pitched to them by songwriters Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty, and they'd presumably be writing the song. So the next Disney movie after Pocahontas could have been this humpback whale movie.
And that's also like, I mean, you're setting yourself up for tragedy there, and it's one of those things of like, you can change a happy ending to this and nobody will be that mad about like, oh, you destroyed it. But like, Orpheus is one of the, you know, greatest tragedies in Western culture. And if you change the ending of that to a happy one, it, I don't know, the video game Hades deals with that in a smart way, but yeah.
They save their Greek mythology for the next movie. So they're making progress on this. After a few months, they've got a rough draft for the movie, a few songs, and a general idea of what shape the movie would take. And then, of course, our good friend Jeffrey Katzenberg enters the picture. We must talk about him on every one of these. I swear to God, he is on like 80% of these podcasts.
I didn't think when we do ones that were released after 1994, we talk about him that much, but I did not understand how long it takes to make one of these films.
This right now, we're in 1993 and he's still there. Yeah. So he calls up Trousdale and Wise and it's like, drop everything. You are going to do The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and Alan Menken and Stephen Schwartz are doing the music. This is going to change your life. And Trousdale and Wise explained, this is not a suggestion. It was an assignment. We were being told this is your next project, and that it was Jeffrey Katzenberg's idea. I went to my art book from 1996. Of course, no mention of Katzenberg. He is persona non grata at Disney at that time. They say, oh, this executive in charge of creative development came up with the idea. I assume he replaced Katzenberg or was a subordinate, and they just needed to give someone the credit for the idea.
Yeah, and you say an executive came up with it, and that covers it. But yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised Katzenberg assigned it to him. And also, like, it totally makes sense. You know, I mean, I got to go with Katzenberg on this one over how they dealt with it with Hercules, because Hercules, it just sounded like Musker and Clements were told, you can't do Treasure Planet.
Yeah.
So dig around in these pitches. Maybe you'll find something. I said, well, people have heard of Hercules. And I'm like, yeah, I guess he has a good Q rating. And that just left them with like an open thing of like, well, what? Hercules is so many stories. Yeah. I can tell this. The Notre Dame is one. It is one story that you can easily like. It had already been in so many films. It's easy to adapt.
Yeah, it's been adapted before. So they sort of had a blueprint. So yeah, the art book credits Creative Affairs Vice President David Stainton as having the idea. Apparently, the fake story is he liked the comic book version as a kid and thought it could make a good Disney movie. But according to Trousdale and Wise in a recent oral history, they said they just got the directive from Jeffrey Katzenberg, and I believe them.
I mean, it's like that guy, even if that guy did back then say, oh, you know, and I was supporting it too because I really like that comic book, or maybe he even first took that to Katzenberg of like, hey, maybe this is an idea.
Yeah,
it doesn't happen unless Katzenberg says it. Like,
it's possible he stole the idea or just took the credit, but he gave the directive. But what Trousdale and Wise didn't know is that they were using they were being used as bait for Menken and Schwartz and vice versa. So Katzenberg approached Menken and Schwartz saying, we got the Beauty and the Beast directors to work on this movie and you're gonna do it. And he did the opposite with Trousdale and Wise, like, we've got the Beauty and the Beast, we've got Menken and Schwartz as doing the songs and you're gonna direct it.
Wow.
So it was like double bait for both sides.
That's you know, he said that Hades in Hercules is probably Katzenberg. That is a very Hades type plan of like, he tells two sides, hey, this person already said yes, so let's all work together. Like, that is classic Hollywood deal making right there. Lying,
it's what he did best.
Being a liar.
So unlike most mandatory directives from executives, people like this idea because they're like, how do we turn this into a Disney movie? And that was really the what was the thought amongst most people, moviegoers and critics. Their approach was, how did Disney do this? How will they do this? In fact, when we go back to that critic episode with the musical Hunch, the idea was like, it's patently ridiculous to make a musical based on The Hunchback of Notre Dame. It is just an insane idea.
Yeah, it's how do you cutify it? How do you sell stuffed toys of it? Like, yeah, it was in the air back then. I remember just like how I was paying attention to people talking about Hercules back then or Pocahontas. Same with this, of people thought, how can Disney do this? How can they pull this off? It's impossible.
And this also is where Walt Disney Animation France enters the picture. So production formally begins in the summer of 93. Go back to our DuckTales movie episode. We talked about how an existing French studio was purchased by Disney to make a DuckTales movie, and then they made a shitty movie because they had no time and money. So after DuckTales the movie, they work on some TV stuff for Disney, then were called back to the big leagues to work on a Goofy movie, and then
this was really good.
Yes. They really proved themselves with that movie. And they would work on most Disney features until 2003, when the studio was shuttered. And presumably the studio still does other stuff. I didn't really look into it.
Man, that 2003 was just like a part of a long, like, just shutdown and just shrink.
I think Japan also shut down then.
Japan, and I think Australia just like shrunk. I don't think they shut down Australia then, but that was this just sad moment of Disney going like, we employ too many 2D artists.
Yeah,
fuck it.
Like, we got computers now.
But I think it's great that the French were involved in this film. That is, it's got to be the most French Disney feature animation, right?
Oh, I for sure. Think.
Like, technically, Beauty and the Beast is set in France, but it never felt French to
me. It's like storybook France. It's not like a literal real building you can go to.
I think of that one guy going like, hey, the baguettes, where are they? Like, give me my baguettes.
it's real, like, real comedy France they're living in there. Yeah. So, the Breezy brothers, these French brothers who were the leaders of this animation studio, according to Trousdale and Wise, they were the spiritual leaders of the production, and they really took charge. So these are the guys who were in charge of the DuckTales movie.
Wow.
And these guys are responsible for some of the most stunning sequences in Hunchback. They came up with the prologue, the entire prologue.
Wow.
And the Hellfire sequence. You can see, you can see their storyboards for the Hellfire sequence in the Art of Hunchback of Notre Dame, and they are stunning. Like, these guys, they were being handcuffed by DuckTales.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Because DuckTales, like, we talked all about it, but, like, there's so much in DuckTales, like, boy, they couldn't execute this right, or, like, here's the budget crunch coming in again, or they ran out of money for shadowing on characters.
And now they're just stuck in the house for 20 minutes.
Yeah. That is so impressive to find out that, like, oh, they really were. So lots of people can say, if I had more budget, this would look really, or if I'd had the real support, this would look way better. But here's the proof.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, those both are the best parts of this movie, for sure.
Apparently, it was their idea to make the prologue a song with spoken parts, and they storyboarded the entire thing. So ultimately, they're responsible for 20% of the finished movie, and I think it is the prologue and the Heaven's Light / Hellfire, which makes up about 20% of the movie, and that's what they did.
Oh, those all look so good. So good.
So Disney was getting really comfortable with co-productions because at this point in time, they were doing so much. So at this point, three features were overlapping in production. Hunchback, Pocahontas, and The Lion King all in production at the same time.
Man, I mean, you know, when Eisner makes the pronouncement of an annual feature, you know, back in the mid-80s, late-80s, like that, you have to, unless you're going to have a feature take only 2 years, which it doesn't for a production, then you have to have so many overlapping groups of people, and that they were able to keep that their talent pool still stayed at a relatively good level for so long with that many concurrent productions is also very impressive.
They were hiring everybody. They're opening studios internationally. They opened up a new studio in Glendale. They just bought this warehouse in Glendale, which they called the animators called Sanctuary, which they just animated Hunchback in that new studio with all of these animators. And along with France, at the time, Disney had a new studio in Florida, which was being set up to animate Mulan and other things, which is now also closed. So that Florida studio did a few little tiny things on this, but they needed everybody to work on this movie.
I am so sad that I never, my family went to Disney World, but never when that studio had like the, oh, it's the animation tour. Watch people make animation like that.
Yeah.
I always wanted to see that at, I guess it's called Hollywood Studios now. In my head, it's always MGM Disney, but yeah.
I really wanted to go ever since I saw Uncle Joey go on Full House.
Yes, and the ads worked.
Yeah.
The ads worked is what we're saying.
And they animated him.
They did.
But it's like, yeah, at the time they were setting up, even in Florida, they were setting up an animation studio because they wanted to make three movies at once forever.
Yes. Yeah.
So thankfully for pre-production of the movie, some members of the team got unrestricted access to the entire cathedral, even the catacombs below, and that really informed them of the power and the majesty of the building they wanted to translate to their animated movie. And in fact, Stephen Schwartz literally wrote out there while in the bell tower looking out over Paris.
Wow. Yeah. You know, that's also interesting because, like, this was on the heels of Euro Disney, and, you know, that was hugely controversial. Yes. In France, to hear that the French government was just like, no, we're opening up the doors, you guys come here. But, you know, for them, like, this is if I'm the French government, I'm thinking this is a commercial for tourists everywhere to come to my city.
And I mean, to be fair, Hugo's novel was a commercial for the building. That's it's like, too, come see the building, appreciate it, give it money, get upset if they tear it down.
Yeah.
So, yes, and we go back to the 80s. We talked about The Great Mouse Detective as one of their first dabblings with computer-assisted animation. From that onwards, we see a little more and a little more steeping into their movies. And here they take it a step further in that they want to have a bunch of crowds. And we know from countless Simpsons commentaries how much a pain in the ass crowds are.
Yep.
So they develop a proprietary software called Crowd, which will fill the scenes with randomly generated characters. And I think they hold up.
Yeah. Even on my big old TV in 4K, they hold up pretty well, I think.
Yeah.
Definitely look better. When I look closely at some of them crowds in Shrek, I was like, don't look too close at them.
This was just like, we can make a bunch of random characters do a series of prescribed animations and make it look convincing. And I like that upon revisiting this, I looked at the characters in the background and they are kind of abstract. There's not a lot of detail. Space Jam does a similar thing, but the characters are very detailed. So you're like, well, there's five Dover boys right here.
There's only so many Looney Tunes and you can spot them all like over and over. Yeah. And I mean, by this point, you know, digitally, they've been animating like their last five features that way. Like, I believe Little Mermaid was the last on cells. Yeah. So,
and they're doing a lot with computers that is very subtle in terms of just like moving the camera and some shots, like, of course, Quasimodo rescuing Esmeralda is very similar to, in concept, spinning the camera around the ballroom in Beauty and the Beast. And I didn't have access to it for this recording, but I remember the DVD has a commentary on it, and that insane push through France at the beginning of the movie.
Oh, God.
They just were talking about this crashed our computers constantly. We almost couldn't do this.
Wow, man.
It was so complicated.
Amazing. Yeah, and what a good use of their resources to, you know, that the central figure of it is, you know, Notre Dame, this cathedral, which is, you know, in a building that does not move or change. Mm-hmm. It's not a living thing. So if you create it in three dimensions, you know, for purposes of shots, it's a static thing. You can it's going to stay in place, unlike, say, a Hydra, which has to emote and change its face and all that.
And a lot of it is in 3D. I was looking through my art book and there were a few illustrations of Notre Dame and I was like, oh, that's a 3D model, isn't it? And it says, no, drawn by this person. And I was like, well, they have very good draftsmen on board for this movie.
Yes, they do.
So I can't talk about every individual animator on this movie. They all did an amazing job, but the star of this movie in terms of character animation is definitely James Baxter.
Oh, yes.
He was chosen to be the lead animator for Quasimodo, and because Quasimodo is such a complicated character in terms of acting and in terms of his form, Baxter was chosen. And rewatching this, it is great. It's some of the best character animation because it is an asymmetrical character with, like, who has very specific actions and movements and emotions, and he carries it through perfectly.
That was the biggest realization I had, aha moment of watching it again this time, was that it made me look up that James Baxter animated it instantly because I was like, whoa, Quasimodo, because his walk cycle alone, just like, for the most simple thing of Quasimodo walks to a table, it is not a natural walk cycle. It'd be easy. No one would give a crap if Quasimodo, despite being like hunched over, if his legs moved normally, but they do not. A leg is turned inward and he has kind of a
like
a little gallop he walks with.
And
he has to move all these things, and and to portray the character of Quasimodo, who has all of this, you know, physical strength while also having these disabilities in his movement, is just incredible. And on top of that, you could totally sell out the character by like, well, we want to have an attractive character, so we'll just shave off all the edges of what is described. But like, no, he has an asymmetrical face. He does, you know, he doesn't have a wart obscuring his eye, but he has one like big thing over his eye. It feels fair to the description of him not having traditionally attractive features while also being a character you don't feel gross looking at. I don't know exactly how I put it, but yeah, James Baxter is like, when we were kids, Glenn Keane, I think, was the only Disney animator I knew the name of.
Same here, yeah.
Because everybody talked about, like, oh, look at all the he did with Ariel and the hair. And, like, Glenn Keane is great. But as I get older, I'm like, oh, James Baxter was the MVP. Like,
and I think he animated, like, a key scene in a like, very important Steven Universe. Is that true?
Yes. Okay. So that is how I got to know James Baxter better, because in our generation of people who grew up to be animators, they love James Baxter. Like, the spirit of the Cimarron only really works because James Baxter is perfect at drawing horses, all that kind of stuff. So the animators first on Adventure Time, they're like, could we get James Baxter to like do original animation for us? And so they named a horse character James Baxter, who just, and it says the name James Baxter.
Wow, I didn't know this.
And the horse like runs on top of a beach ball and does all these impossible things because he animated it. And I won't spoil the scene because it pretty much is like the climactic scene of Steven Universe. But because it was so important, Rebecca Sugar, she was owed a favor by James Baxter and said, please, can you animate this? And it's animated on the ones. It is the second that scene starts, you're like, this is not TV animation. You know it. And it's kind of a tribute to what is probably James Baxter's masterpiece scene, which is the dance in Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
Like the turn when Beast like moves her forward and turns to his friends and like looks at him and goes like, hey, like that is like a triumphant moment. And that's James Baxter right there.
And he also did an opening, some scenes in the opening of Gravity Falls.
Yes.
Like
yeah,
Dipper
yeah.
with the candle. Like it's very, yeah. very fluid and extremely
yeah,
well
with
done.
The candle, and also the shot of Mabel hugging her pig and rubbing her face into it. Like, yeah, it's
I'm looking at his history, and like he would do like very feminine characters at first. Like he was the character lead animator for Ariel, and Belle would be lead animator for Rafiki, and then he would jump to DreamWorks. And you know, seeing how Katzenberg just like robbed Disney of all these 2D animators, it makes me want to watch movies like The Prince of Egypt and The Road to El Dorado and the Horse movie, because I've never seen any of these, even Sinbad.
Yeah,
like, and there are all these Disney animators I love who worked on these movies that I just didn't even look at twice.
And you know what? I think we're gonna have to do a 2D DreamWorks poll one of these days. But yeah,
as long as we just get away from the 3D stuff.
Yeah, Baxter, just one of the greatest, who I really only appreciated because of people our generation working with him on their shows and in getting his name back out there. And just watch. He put up his own reel on YouTube.
Ooh.
If you watch his reel, you're like, oh, that was every favorite scene I had as a kid growing up.
And let's see. He's still working. Like he recently worked on things like Klaus, that Netflix animated movie.
Oh, yeah.
I still
really
want to watch that.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't mention every animator. We'll mention a few more throughout, but I want to wrap up the movie history, move on to like the writing and the music and the voice acting. So this movie, despite what people have the assumption of, it was not a failure. Off a budget of $70 million, it made $325 million.
That's really good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Lion King made like $1 billion, and Disney was like, everything that is not the Lion King is a failure, which means everything they've made before Frozen to them was a failure, because they could never hit Lion King numbers until Frozen came out.
That's, you know, it's always wanting more. That's the problem.
And it made a bit less than Pocahontas, but much more than Hercules.
Hercules, well, then they'd have a bigger flop after Hercules. Yeah. But that was seen as more as like, oh, first they had Hunchback not perform as well, and then Hercules, Disney's really losing it.
And the problem for Disney is they wanted a prestige Oscar-winning movie, but Hunchback was unmarketable in the Disney tradition of being a family film. So that's why we'll talk about it a lot. That's why the gargoyles are there. That's why there's some slapstick humor. And also during press for the movie, Jason Alexander stepped in some shit when he said he was very proud of his role in the movie, but he also said, I would not take my 4-year-old son to this movie.
Oh, dang. I forgot that. Damn.
He was like, it's too mature. I would wait a few years. He's not ready for this. And Disney was like, no. It's a celebration of love and acceptance and fun. Topsy-turvy. Woo, party time. So yeah, in the press, Jason Alexander was like, don't take your kids to see this movie.
Yeah, I don't think I'd take, if I had a 6-year-old, I would not show them this. I think I'd have to wait like 8. I'd say maybe at 8, especially like, you've seen enough like recommendations for Joe Rogan in your YouTube videos, kid. Yeah. So you can take watching Quasimodo be mocked and spun around like that. That's the hardest one to me for a kid. I felt, because that, how can you not, you know, associate yourself with Quasimodo watching it? Like, you're like, oh, that's the audience character.
Yeah.
And so when he is so just humiliated, and in a much nicer way than he's treated in the book, of course, when he's flogged in the book. But
I mean they avoided the backlash and stuff, and people took their kids to see it, and it was a big hit. But I think largely the impression was that we carry today is like, oh, it was a flop, but it wasn't. Was not a flop.
Well, I read one of the 25th anniversary pieces I read was the New York Times one about like how they even got it to be a G rating, because they're all the people involved are just like, I have no clue, like, honestly, it shouldn't be, we got away with it. If we made this now, no way is it a G rated movie.
Yeah, rewatching this, I was like, just make it PG. I mean, there's drinking, there's smoking, there's like lust.
Yeah,
I don't know how this is G other than Disney has a lot of power.
They had that much power. Yeah. And just said like, this should be a G. If you make this PG, we lose money, so don't do that. Like that, they have an entire song called Hellfire. Mm-hmm. Like that's in that G-rated article. That was the one, I think it was Mencken who says like, when they were writing it, they thought, this will never get made, no way, we'll not get a G rating, and yet it happened.
I think the one request was like, hey, when Frollo sings Sin, can you make the fire make a loud noise so it mutes the word sin a little bit?
That's so funny. Yeah. The word sin was like, oh, that's too far. Yeah. That's not Esmeralda doing basically a pole dance.
Man, that is nuts. Yeah, yes. That I have new appreciation for that.